Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Victor Sung, the director of the UAB Huntington Disease Clinic and the co-director of the UAB School of Medicine Neuroscience Module, as well as the director of the Birmingham VAMC Deep Brain Stimulation Program. He detailed data on the cost of genetic testing for Huntington disease that he and colleagues presented earlier this year at the International Parkinson and Movement Disorders Society Congress, as well as the current utilization of testing in clinical practice, and a little bit of why there's so much variation in cost from center to center. So without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Victor Sung. I'm a neurologist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. I'm the director of the HDSA Huntington's Disease Center of Excellence here at UAB. And I'm also chair of the National Board of Trustees of the Huntington's Disease Society of America. I have been at different Huntington's disease meetings and have heard people discuss their processes for predictive genetic testing. And just at a glance, it seemed like there was more variability in the exact testing process, even though technically we're all supposed to adhere to the same HDSA guidelines. And I wondered whether or not that variability in the process also led to variability in the cost. I had had a few patients who had come to me who had started the testing process at other centers of excellence, and the cost that was presented to them was more than they could afford. And then they had reached out to me and we were able to do it for less. And so that really led to the project, you know, and I thought, oh gosh, if we're all supposed to be doing it the same way, maybe they aren't, certainly if there's variations in cost leading to some patients going from one center to another, then maybe we should take a look at this. And all of our centers of excellence, we have to submit annual progress reports that detail how we do predictive genetic testing and the costs of all those pieces. And so I said, well, that's the easiest way to find that data. And I asked HDSA to compile that data for me. Obviously, they de-identified it, you know, but they compiled the raw data that all the sites had submitted for what do they do into a spreadsheet. And then I, you know, reformatted it so that I could see clearly what are the different pieces that are done and what are the costs for those parts that are done. And then there was some narrative interpretation in there about, you know, for costs, a lot of people would put, well, this is the cost asterisk, but if there's some, you know, extenuating circumstances, then we can pay for it and things like that. So I took all that into consideration and then just tabulated it up. And as you saw in the abstract, there was a pretty wide variation from just a few hundred dollars for the entire testing process to a few thousand dollars or multiple, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 even for the full testing price. And that is, to me, a wider variation than we would like to see. Obviously, every center has to conform to institutional standards and is going to have limitations there. This is stuff that I would write about in the paper, but some of the interesting things there were some of the narratives were like, a lot of centers don't have in-house genetic testing labs. So if you don't have a genetic testing lab, then what a lot of centers do is then find another lab that offers the test at a cheap price. And so then they use that lab and that cuts the price down. But then interestingly, some of the centers that have their own in-house genetic testing lab at their university, they're essentially confined to that. They must use that lab, and they're confined to the price that that lab charges, even if it's more than what they want. So it's just interesting. So there was a lot of variation in the cost of the genetic test itself, and then the different components of it. Probably the variation, one of the most costly components was neuropsychological testing, if that was involved in the testing process. That was expensive, often not covered by insurance. And the sites that use that as part of their testing process all had a higher cost due to that high cost piece. But those are some of the simplest findings. You know, just that there was a lot of cost variation, and especially for the you know, the centers that where their testing cost is multiple thousands of dollars, I can certainly see that being a barrier. You know, we were just looking at the testing process and the cost of that. You know, obviously we don't have any access to patient survey data or anything like that, but I would just imagine that if the testing process is multiple thousand dollars, then that could be a barrier to access to that, you know, for certain patients or for many patients.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I'm glad you brought up the neuropsychic assessment, because that was one of the things, obviously, kind of, you know, parsing through it, you're looking at, you know, all these, you know, different variations that like not every single of the 46, you know, so only,
right,
what was it, like 11 of the centers assessed, right, had neuropsychology as even like a thing that could happen. So I would really wonder, you know, how much that drives the cost up versus, you know, things like having to outsource testing, driving it down,
right,
those other factors. Is there a plan to, you know, because again, like you said, the idea was, let's just sort of look at what the state of this is, and then you find this huge variance. Is that enough to prompt you guys to say, hey, maybe this is something we need to look at further? Is this creating a barrier to care, you know, to access? I know that's a tricky one in Huntington's because of the, you know, the decision to get tested.
Right. That's right.
A whole nother thing. But do you, like, are you guys prepared, or do you plan on doing more sort of digging into this?
Yeah. You know, I think the next step, so we, the project that we had was based on, I think, just 2 years worth of data.
Okay.
And we have more data now. So that was done a few years ago. So we have 2 more years of data. And so we're going to combine that together and look at, because like you said, you know, with just 11 of the centers and just 2 years worth of data, and maybe things, the costs, people are bringing it down, I don't know. So we're going to take a look at, do these same trends hold over more time, bringing it up to, we have data up to the 2021 application now. So, you know, we're going to take a look at that, and then see, do these patterns kind of hold, and get that out there. And then we'll take a look at, you know, I think the next steps would be to take it to look at the patient level. Do they think that it's a barrier? You know, that's a little bit trickier, because that would involve surveying patients that are getting testing. And there is, you know, the thing that we've talked about is there's an inherent thing. If people have made that decision to want to go forward with testing, usually they're fairly committed to it and are going to find a way. But, you know, so I wonder if there will be some bias there. But, I mean, we don't know until we take a look at it. And I think that's the next step, is just taking it to the patients and asking them, was cost a barrier? You know, did it? Yeah. Even if they still completed testing, did it delay their testing because they had to, you know, acquire the financial means to pay for the testing or whatever, right? You know, I think there's multiple ways to get at that. Is it a barrier? You know, it's hard to, and I don't have a good sense of how to capture, well, what if it was such a barrier that the patients stopped testing altogether? You know, and didn't complete the process. There is a part, like one line in the data that I can kind of use for that, that asks about, like, in a narrative way, you know, how many patients do you have that started the testing process but didn't complete it? Yeah. And what I could look at is, does that correlate? You know, like the centers that have the highest number of patients that did started the testing process and didn't complete it are those the centers that have the highest testing costs. And if there's a correlation there, then I think it would suggest that, you know, but I think that's something that, you know, next steps to kind of take a look at too. And the thing with that is I've looked at that a little bit in the first set of data that I have, and the numbers are very small and it's not enough for me to say anything. So, but I'm hoping that over, you know, two more years of data and having more numbers of patients that start the testing process and don't complete it, I can maybe say something. Is there a correlate to testing price?
I wonder, so how, because again, like this, what makes this like very hard to talk about is just because genetic testing in Huntington is kind of a, you know, a larger conversation as a whole. And I know you had mentioned in, you know, our conversations over email that the sort of ongoing clinical development may be driving a little more interest from patients right. or those who are at risk to right. undergo this testing. Do you think that's also part of this, is that we need to identify potentially if more patients than normal or more at-risk individuals rather than normal are identifying testing? Because I know that's, again, that's sort of a very personal decision to yeah. undergo that and find out that diagnosis. So I'm for you, what, you know, how do you describe the sort of current state of that? Do you think that there's a way to determine if that's going on?
I mean, so a couple of things. I mean, you know, we do have data that suggests that of the people who are eligible for testing in the United States, only 10% pursue testing. And for the 90% who don't, the top reason that they give for not testing is the lack of something that can be done about it. You know, basically, like, why would I test if there's nothing that I can do about it? And so I started this project, you know, as we were embarking on our biggest disease modifying phase 3 trial that ultimately now has not panned out. But I think that it gives us a little bit of a window. I think this is something that we need to sort out as a community before, you know, the big trials start to come to fruition, because then we're going to get hit with this onslaught of people wanting to get tested. And if we're not ready for that, if we haven't addressed barriers to access, then we're going to be behind, you know? So I think, is it discernible? It's tricky because, like you said, the people that choose not to get tested, a lot of times, you know, they're not patients. How are we going to access these people? How are we going to access them to survey them? You know, I think the only thing we can do is really look at the people that start the process and don't complete it and ask them what were the factors that contributed to that. But those numbers are small, but can we get to that somehow? And I think if we do it together as a community, that is one good thing, is that, you know, the HD Center of Excellence community is pretty united, unified. I think we can answer those questions. But we'd have to do it together. But, you know, I think that's my goal with that, is to get people to be interested in pursuing that together. I think we have to put that information out there that there is variability. Yeah. And so then we have to be motivated to then reduce that variability and reduce the cost and reduce barriers. So you see what I mean? Like, yeah. you know, just putting out there that there may be barriers that we're not aware of, that there is more variability than we think, gets people to think about it. You know, we have pretty regular, like we have one coming up on Zoom, Zoom calls of all the Center of Excellence directors. So this is an opportunity. Once I get it published and out there, then, you know, we can talk about it together.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Sung to keep you up to date with the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. Our first bit of news comes from Renew Biosciences, a medical technology company that announced this week that the FDA had granted its Sarazen device a breakthrough designation in the treatment of mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, and mild Alzheimer's disease dementia. The device itself offers a four-step process for use, beginning with the securing of the inflatable cuffs to the patient's hips, thighs, and calves, followed by the inflation of the cuffs in order to compress blood vessels and enhance blood flow.
Afterward, the cuffs deflate in order to reduce the effort needed for the heart to pump oxygenated blood throughout the body. The Renew Biosciences device uses external counterpulsation in order to do this in a process that must be conducted under the supervision of a physician, but that the company calls, quote, soothing and relaxing for patients, somewhat like a massage. Also in Alzheimer news, Eli Lilly announced that it has initiated the rolling submission of a biologics license application for donanemab, an investigational antibody therapy, to the FDA for accelerated approval in early AD. The basis for this decision was data from the Phase 2 Trailblazer ALZ study, which showed that when compared to placebo, donanemab slowed the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Additionally, the company announced plans to conduct Trailblazer ALZ-4, a phase 3 head-to-head trial comparing donanemab to aducanumab, Biogen's Aduhelm, which was recently approved in June. This past June, Eli Lilly announced that the FDA had granted a breakthrough therapy designation to donanemab. Our final bit of news today is that Amylyx Pharmaceuticals has submitted a new drug application to the FDA for its investigational treatment AMX-35 for the treatment of patients with ALS. The NDA is supported by data from the Phase 2-3 CENTAUR trial, which showed that treatment with the agent met the primary efficacy endpoint, reporting an average ALS-FRS-R score of 2.32 points higher than placebo after 24 weeks. Joshua Cohen, CEO and chairman and co-founder of Amylyx, said in a statement that the company's team has worked and continues to work around the clock as they know time is of the essence for people with ALS and their families, and they will continue to keep the community closely updated on their NDA progress. For more information about these stories, you can head over to neurologylive.com or check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Sung.
And I mean, that's interesting because obviously it does, and everyone I've talked to in the Huntington's community has kind of echoed the same thing, that it's a very tight-knit community. There's a lot of good communication. I'm curious, you know, because it does seem like, again, you know, this year there's been a few setbacks, obviously, earlier in the year with a few things being discontinued or not panning out. And it feels very much like we are on the brink of something, though.
Right.
Some sort of step in Huntington's. And I'm curious, do you think that, you know, I guess this is kind of a twofold question. Do you think that when that step is made, obviously what you said before, it does sound like you're anticipating that would prompt more at-risk individuals to at least consider genetic testing?
Yeah,
I think definitely so, yeah.
What is the role of these centers of excellence, this sort of larger community, and specifically also the HDSA is in getting that awareness and that education done, you know, prior to that influx potentially of new patients or of people who say, you know, now this is something I want to talk to my physician about or talk to a neurologist about. You know, what's sort of how do we address that sort of preemptive awareness campaign?
Yeah, you know, and I think there's multiple ways. I think it's through HDSA as being the one voice or like the loudest voice to the community in addressing that. I think HDSA does a good job with their annual convention on having a whole track for pre-symptomatic patients, you know, basically like a whole, even though it's a convention with multiple different pathways, there's multiple different pathways, right? There's the track with whole education pieces about if you're in the, you know, not tested, considering it kind of group, or if you're symptomatic and, you know, it's just, you have different concerns. And so they have different parallel tracks on that. So using that convention, that forum, and then just using that community of the Center of Excellence directors to kind of push the message out. You know, that's one thing that's strong in that the Center of Excellence program has grown in the last 5 years significantly, so that a lot more geographically of the United States is covered by that program. So hopefully we can have reach to more patients. You know, and then it's hard though, like the people that bypass the testing process, which we feel strongly about is the better and more supportive way to do it. There are some people that are just testing with their primary doctors. I get it. It's a path of least resistance. It's easier to do. But there are problems with that, because then if they test positive, then they're not connected to anybody that can answer the next questions that come up, right? So, you know, it's a delicate balance, I think, between while we feel like the protocol that's put out there is the right way and it supports the patients the best, you know, we have to, if we want patients to follow that protocol, then we have to eliminate or reduce any kinds of barriers to doing that so that they do that and not bypass the entire protocol altogether, right? So, you know, I think that just getting the message out within our center of excellence community is a good start, and then kind of take the message out past that.
I agree, because I imagine it would you know, and especially if they're going to primary care, and then like you said, they test positive, it creates this sort of stopgap between, well, now what? And,
right.
You know, how do I get in touch? And now you're establishing care ahead of, you know, as a reaction rather than slightly proactively. I'm curious for you, the last thing I want to ask you related to, you know, sort of genetic testing before we get to those last few things is just, you know, obviously medicine and neurology specifically, it seems like there's been just a ton of in terms of the push toward getting to precision medicine, and obviously doing genetic testing is, you know, step one to that. For you, you know, what are some of the advances in whether it's therapeutic development or whether it is in sort of how we're sequencing through this genetic testing and just sort of our understanding of Huntington's as a whole? For you, what's kind of been the big steps we've taken ahead of this, you know, potential therapeutic breakthrough that we may see in the next couple of years?
I think the technology has made huge strides, right? I mean, these things that we sequenced the gene for Huntington's disease back in the 80s. And I still remember, the test was commercially available in 1993. And I was in high school then, but I still remember people talking about like, oh, the gene is sequenced. Now, just within a few years, we're going to be able to cure this disease. And the technology just wasn't able to do that then. But we're getting closer and closer to being able to do things genetically with that we weren't able to do before. So I think there's been great progress there and pushing that science forward, embracing the genetic aspects of it. The other thing too is through really large global studies like Enroll-HD, it's an observational trial, but they collect gobs and gobs of genetic data. And the depth of, I mean, it's so much more complicated now than we thought, that Huntington's disease is a single gene disease. The genetics, even of just something as relatively simple as Huntington's disease, turn out to be very complicated. And which tells us two things. It's one, it advances the story and helps us to understand the disease better. But all these other genetic factors that are related in Huntington's disease that are not purely just on the gene itself or that are kind of around it or other genes, things like that, it actually gives us more therapeutic targets. And I think that's another big area of an advancement is if you look at, like, I think the wave that's still ongoing and I think will have a lot of impact, you know, that unfortunately we've had some failures, is really been like, okay, genetic therapies targeted at the Huntington's gene itself and the translation of the Huntington's gene. And I still think that that's going to have high impact and biggest bang for your buck for curative things. But if you look at the next wave, what's coming in 2022, immediately and beyond, or even later this year and beyond, is there are multiple companies with splicing agents and modifiers that are actually addressing other genes that alter the expression of the Huntington's gene. And those can have impact too. So, you know, we have a whole new wave of genetically based therapies that are not necessarily directly targeting the Huntington's gene itself. I think that's huge advancements. And then we've done a pretty good job, although I think we can do better, in pushing out education programs and training more genetic counselors. I think that's another key piece that we need to do as a community, is emphasizing the role of genetic counselors and training up more genetic counselors. I'm fortunate to be at an institution where we have a master's of genetic counseling training program. So, you know, I get to work with those students and emphasize, hey, you know, Huntington's disease is really important. Wherever you go out in the country, take this training, and specifically in genetic counseling and Huntington's disease, and take it out there. But I think that that's another area where we've grown, but we need more growth too, is in training up more genetic counselors that are experienced in HD.
Last question I want to ask you. Thank you for being so gracious with your time. I really do appreciate it. Just MDS overall, what have your thoughts, just overall, your takeaways been on the meeting? Obviously, you know, it being virtual this year, a little different than prior years, but
yeah,
you know, your just overall takeaways from MDS 2021.
I think that, you know, my big takeaway is that despite challenges because of the global pandemic, there's clearly still really good work being done, that the big trials have found a way to persevere despite challenges of COVID. I think everybody would have thought like all the big trials are going to be halted and patients aren't going to want to do it. But I think it's a testament to the community, both patients and investigators, coordinators, that the science has continued to move forward despite challenges of a global pandemic. You know, that's been a theme for me, is like there's still good stuff happening. It's not just like, it would be easy to have a virtual meeting that just recaps stuff that was done in 2019 and before, right? You know, and then we just skip over 2020 as a lost year. But clearly there's still good work being done. And that's a testament to the perseverance of all investigators and patients. So that's kind of my big takeaway.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.